Hello everyone, Matt here again. This is the second in the series of putting stuff back onto the feed, just for the short story. Previous host removed 7 episodes from the feed for reasons they never fully could tell me, so I'm putting them back on to the new feed or the new host. So this is Harmonium by Vanessa Carlton and my friend Kaylee, which I think was in 2019, this is early 2020, so this was even before the last episode. So, yeah, so I don't really have much more to say about this, so let's revisit that episode.
We made this.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Pick a Disc. I am your host, Matt Latham, and I'm here to talk to someone about a disc that they've picked for whatever reason they want to talk about it. And for this edition of the podcast, I'm delighted to welcome back Kaylee Roberts, who appeared on the podcast all the way back in episode 2 when I was still trying to figure out how to do this thing. So it's great to actually be able to speak to her again on the podcast. The album we're talking about today is Harmonium by Vanessa Carlton. We talk about all sorts of things involving Vanessa. We talk about the reception of the album. We talk about some controversy with the album and the impact that that had on the album's promotion and inevitable lack of success. We'd also talk about why she liked it. We also talk about live music and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, I won't spoil it for you. You just have to listen to find out what happened, like any normal podcast listener does. And if, like any other normal podcast listener, you'd go and follow us on all the sorts of social medias and, you know, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook under Pick a Disc, the Facebook group Pick a Disc, and just share the love, if you know what I mean. Not that I'm suggesting that people who don't do that aren't normal, but 99.9% of people who are good people and honest people will support the podcast. Wink. Don't forget to also commit opinion fraud and give us 5 stars on iTunes, as you do. I think that's it. It's time to talk to Kaylee. Off mic, we were just discussing about the weather. So I was discussing the weather, and us, me being in Britain, we over-exaggerate and love to moan about it, whereas pretty much the US can pretty much get hit by anything and just brush it off. So, yeah, it's like very British about the weather, where we're not very British about the weather, which is kind of a weird oxymoron. Anyway, how are you, Kaylee?
I am doing well. I'm staring at the snow, and I'm done thinking about weather. Let's talk about music.
Yes. Kaylee, back again after a long time. I think you was my second ever episode way back in the old days. You were like the old guard.
Yeah, I mean, I helped you, you know, give you the courage to go forward, I think, and I'm glad I could be a part of that.
Yeah. I'm not going to use the word guinea pig and get all the mistakes out of the way first. But no, it's... I recently re-listened to a chat about Say Anything's In Defense of the Genre, and it's almost oddly nostalgic. But what it also reminded me is that I think from the first lot of guests, I think you're the last to reappear. So I think Kurt appeared on the 10th episode. Helena's appeared twice. Colin just sometimes hangs around outside my house with the podcast equipment and like just randomly says, "Let's do a podcast," after circling my block for about 3 months straight. But yeah, I think it's about time I had you back to talk about another album.
Well, I mean, I'm constantly throwing you podcast ideas. You're just lucky I'm not closer like he is, or I might be lurking as well. So
yeah, I'll have a queue. I'll have a ticket machine going next. Okay. Yeah, so let's jump to it. Kaylee, why don't you tell the audience the disc that you've picked?
Well, the disc that I picked was Harmonium by Vanessa Carlton. I want to say it's her second or third studio album. I don't remember. But it's a very interesting piece, both the music and what went on behind it. So when it popped into my brain a few weeks ago, one of my first thoughts was, I could have a talk with Matt about that.
So why have you picked it, though? I mean, aside from, I'm assuming, is it just interesting, or is it... Why this album? Why did you want to talk about it?
I think there's a lot about it that fans of music and Vanessa Carlton specifically never would have known about were it not for the internet. And the internet's kind of what re-piqued my interest in the album. I was reading about it and I knew a little bit about the controversies that had surrounded it at the time, but I was also only, I think, 15 or 16 then. So as the information behind it has evolved, it kind of felt like a good place to jump back in as an adult.
Yeah, I mean, and I think I remember messaging you when I was doing some preliminary research in that. My knowledge of just Vanessa was just basically a thousand miles. Which I think was like her only hit here, I think. Yeah, it got to number 6 in the UK charts, and it spent 21 weeks there. And I know that because I've now discovered officialcharts.com, which gives me the UK performance of an artist of all their songs that are released in this country. And it's only taken me 29 episodes to discover it. So guess what, listeners? You'll probably be listening to that. You'll probably be listening to that a bit more from now on. Yeah, I think that's about it. I think she was then involved with the cover of Big Yellow Taxi with Counting Crows, and that's all, I think, that I know about her.
Yeah, I believe she was touring with them and ended up dating the lead singer, and he was the producer for this Harmonium, this album we're talking about. So
that was Third Eye Blind. That was the guy behind Third Eye Blind, not Counting Crows.
Oh, right. You're right. I've got them mixed up. Yeah, Stephen Jenkins.
Yeah.
I have heard that one you're talking about. I can hear it now in my head. Counting Crows one. But
it's, I think it was a cover, but that's really all I know about it. And reading into Vanessa Carlton, she's kind of interesting character, to be fair. Some interesting decisions and stuff, but we won't jump that far ahead. How did you discover Vanessa Carlton then? What was your first foray into her music?
I sincerely have no idea. I listened to so much back then. Again, I would have been my second year of high school. So I would have been about 16, 17 when this album came out, I think 16. And I was inhaling so much music back then. It could have been online. It could have been on MTV. It could have been, I don't know. But I don't know where I first found it, but I know that 15 years later, I still know every single word. So wherever I found it, it latched onto me.
Because I think this was a second album. The first album is the one with 1,000 Miles and I think Ordinary Day. And I think there was another one which wasn't here. So Ordinary Day, I think, might have got some play over here, but didn't make a dent like 1,000 Miles. Do you think, was her first album, like 1,000 Miles on her first album, your entry into her? Or was that, can you remember those songs? Were they any big over there? Or?
The 1,000 Miles and the other one, what was the other one you said?
Ordinary Day.
Yeah, they were quite big here on the radio, but I didn't have the album. So it was something with Harmonium that spoke to me enough that I, you know, bought the album, went to the concert, bought the t-shirt, that whole nine yards. So.
Okay, so this was the first album that you listened from Vanessa Carlton, or at least your entry, yeah. Okay, so to answer that question, Vanessa Carlton is an American musician, singer and songwriter, delves into piano, pop, rock type genre. She released a debut single, 1,000 Miles, which I think reached top 5 in the Billboard Hot 10, and as I said earlier, reached number 6 in the UK. Her debut album was Be Not Everybody, which I think which reached platinum. And then a few years later, she released Harmonium, which is the album that we're talking about. And it's a quite interesting album, and so interesting with some like really weird and bizarre controversies around it. In terms of it in general, what would you say, if you was to like describe it in a few words, what would you say about the album? How would you describe it all?
I think it's an accidental contemporary pop experiment album. I don't feel as though she went into it trying to create all these different distinct sounds, but I think the turmoil behind the scenes and the lack of vision, it really made it a contemporary pop experiment.
Yeah, I mean, judging from the research I've done, the word harmonium, apparently she says she adopted the word and made her own definition for it. She intended it to be a portmanteau of the words harmony and pandemonium to define the approach of the recording of the album, which she described as a kind of organised, chaotic approach where I wanted to maintain and preserve that wild abandon to creating, which, from what you said, it's a fitting name.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it was kind of like all over the place in the recording of it, I believe. So she started in San Francisco before, and I quite like this fact, actually. Recording then moved to the Skywalker Ranch.
I literally just learned that today. Research myself.
Yeah, that's weird.
It might explain why I was so drawn to it.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's... yeah, so, like, it was basically recorded by George Lucas founded and stuff, and it is a interesting album, but, like, it does feel like it's experimental, but it kind of, it doesn't have a central sound or theme to it. It just seems very, there's a lot of different ideas piling onto each other, where yeah. she's experimenting on that. And it makes it quite interesting on that level, but kind of lacking identity in others, if that's fair to say.
Absolutely. I think even without the controversy that we'll talk about that surrounded the album, I don't think it was ever going to be a smash hit, because I think she was just pulled creatively in too many different directions with her ideas, and it didn't ever go back to one central place, unfortunately. Because there are some songs on here that now that I've heard it again, I know they're going to make it into my regular rotation, but just as a whole, doesn't really work.
She said, I'm going to quote from here as well. It seemed to be a reaction to the previous album, which was Be Not Everybody. I'm going to quote Wikipedia, where it says, she called the album a reflection of a different and more womanly perspective of the world, as opposed to the innocent and girlish quality of Be Not Everybody. However, she says that although things get a bit heavier as you get older, she still has that lightness of youth and is able to be as girly in the ways that it should be. She referred to the album as bittersweet rather than just bitter, and stressed the importance of the lyrics and harmonium compared to those on Be Not Nobody, which she said was more focused on the music. I don't think the album itself and the lyrics comment on fame or the reaction to it, so it doesn't, unfortunately, this doesn't class as a Money and Bling album, unfortunately. It's not really about, the fame that she has, but there are parts of it, I think, are reactionary to her previous album, which was a lot more younger and innocent, wide-eyed.
Absolutely. I think that with the first album, she was giving people what she was told to give people, you know, that innocence, that persona, and it's clear with this album that she had no intentions of sticking to that.
Yeah. So, because I found quite interesting. So, I mean, this was 2004, I remember the same time, or a few years beforehand, you had other contemporaries of the kind of young female singer-songwriter coming up into the mainstream pop artists. Now, the ones I'm thinking of is that you had Michelle Branch, Avril Lavigne, Stacey Orlico, and then towards the more poppy side, you've got like Jessica Simpson and that kind of stuff. And there's a kind of weird spectrum where you had the like Jessica Simpson, Britney Spears, Christina Aguilera, kind of pure pop sound stuff. Then you moved perhaps across a spectrum. Then you had like Michelle Branch, which had the acoustic guitar as a USP. You had Avril Lavigne with a pop punk electric guitar aspect to it. And then Vanessa Carlton had the piano. The piano was a kind of USP, but she was kind of lumped. And I always thought she was lumped towards those kind, not onto the Britney Spears level, but she was like in the Michelle Branch, Avril Lavigne era of marketable.
It does, absolutely. And even if you look at the album cover for Harmonium, she's wearing like slip-on sneakers, kind of a Converse style, and like a lacy top. And they were very much pushing an image that maybe even her music didn't fit. But I think that was just because of the times.
So I did a little digging as well. She's a few years older than Michelle Branch and Avril Lavigne and like JoJo and Stacey Orenica. I can never pronounce her name. Orenica, the one who did There's Gotta Be More to Life. What was it? Yes, that one, yes. She's a couple of years older. In fact, she said she's the same age as Regina Spektor and just a couple years younger than Amanda Palmer, Fiona Apple. And part of me, particularly like the last week when I've been listening to reviews and stuff and listening to videos, I have a feeling that Vanessa Carlton perhaps never saw herself as the more pop side of stuff. I think she perhaps saw herself as a more cultish, respected figure like Regina Spektor, who was also kind of like a piano pop thing, but was never lumped in with, like your Michelle Branches and your Avril Lavigne's. Yeah.
I never really thought of that, but now that you say it, it's kind of It definitely makes sense.
Because Regina Spektor was never lumped in that section, but she's the same age as Vanessa Carlton. I mean, she was, I think they're both 39. And I think, I'm just wondering whether it's because, and I'm quite loath to talk about physical appearance, but Vanessa Carlton looked a lot younger than she was, I think, particularly with the 1,000 Miles video, whereas Regina Spektor looked like an adult, whereas like Vanessa Carlton still felt like she was just coming over 10 years when she was probably a few years older than she was. And I think that's when the A&R people latched on and kind of lumped her into that.
I think that could definitely be a part of it. I think a big part of it also is you have artists like Regina Spektor, and they're kind of weird coming out of the gate. I'm not sure what a better word is. The atypical, where she, you know, Regina Spektor is like folk pop or post-folk pop or whatever she's called this week. She was always that. So I think the biggest reason that someone like her and someone like Vanessa Carlton went in two different directions is because they were pushed in different directions. Or, you know, like you said, A&R seemed to be pigeonholing Vanessa Carlton in a way that similar artists never experienced.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So if you talk about the songs as a whole, or select songs, which songs jump out to you as like favorites if I was to put you on the spot?
Afterglow, I really like. It's just calming and sweet. And lyrically, it sounds like a lot of her other writings. It's simple and calm. I really like White Houses. A big part of that's nostalgia. I like it a lot because of the controversy. And then I think Private Radio is another one I really like because it's different, but it still really fits with the album better than a lot of the other more different songs.
Yeah. I'll go back to White Houses in a bit because there's a bit of a conversation I want to have a bit about that. But if we go to Private Radio, I actually quite like Private Radio. It definitely has that kind of mid-album, early noughties kind of pop rock sound to it. So it sounds like it belongs in the middle of an album. Yeah, and it's got that kind of like pop sound to it. But it also sounds like it's about to morph and threaten to morph into Smells Like Teen Spirit at sometimes. Because like it's a bit where it kicks into the chorus, like when the night comes. It's like, I'm completely sure that matches Smells Like Teen Spirit. It's like, to the point where he goes, when the night comes, entertain us! And
now I'm going to be singing it like that forever. But yeah, I know what you mean. There's that build that comes with the chorus. It's kind of a threat of more of a burst of energy. And then she kind of loops back to the la-di-da of the next verse. And it's a really good dynamic. And the lyrics are also really good. I feel like I'm in her brain.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's like pretty much like, I like the concept of a private radio is kind of like your internal like voice, so to speak.
Yeah, I think it was like she's talking about like all the melodies inside her head and something in a bed. Then there's a rhyme there, but I feel like it's a little bit of her pre-process that we're seeing, or like how the songs build in her head and how she, you know, she grows them and kind of listens to them herself as she's writing them. So that's one of the reasons I really like it.
Yeah, and it's that kind of like nice sound to it as well. I probably want to go back to the song. I'll quickly mention, I think, the song Annie, which was about a fan that she found or a girl she met.
Yeah, there's doesn't seem to be a concrete story, but from what I could find through like Reddit and stuff, it was a sick, I think, leukemia patient that she went to visit who inspired her song.
Yeah, and I think it's one of the more interesting stories of the album, because I think she pretty much like talks about it. It's literally about her like popping into a hospital to like meet people, and like the first like few lines says a day out from the county ICU for a second, and it's quite, I mean, I say quite dark for a like pop album, but the album doesn't hide that, if that makes sense.
Yeah, Annie's very, I don't know. It's a weird song for me. I like it, but it makes me a little uncomfortable at the same time. And I get that art should do that. And I think that's part of what she was going for. I really like she mentions kind of feeling helpless in that situation.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what made the song feel very real to me and make me believe that it was coming from a real experience.
Yeah.
Not the thing I would write a song about, but I also don't have a platinum album, so.
Definitely. I mentioned that, but then you mentioned White Houses, because that was the first, because it's the only single and the only video from that album. And
right.
When I first played it and it started coming up with the piano stuff, immediately I thought, yeah, okay, this, I completely believe that this is the next step from the person that did 1,000 Miles. And it does actually build quite well to a good pop song. Cause I think the verses kick in and then you get to the chorus and then I think the electric guitar kicks in. There's acoustic guitar that's actually played by Lindsey Buckingham.
Right? Yeah. That was just the most bizarre fact to uncover.
Yeah, so you got like a member of Fleetwood Mac that just randomly comes in and plays acoustic for like, I don't know, a few bars of a riff, which is ridiculous. And bizarre when you think about it. But there was controversy about it. I'll let you expand on the controversy around it.
Okay, essentially MTV, always known for their pure and modest television, had a bit of a problem with a very chaste, subtle reference to one losing their virginity. I don't have the lyric in front of me. I'm not sure if you do.
Yes, I think it's the bridge where it goes, my first time, hard to explain, rush of blood, oh, and a little bit of pain. On a cloudy day, it's more common than you think. Here's my first mistake.
Yeah. First of all, side note, if this song came out today, I'm pretty sure people would love it. There would be very little controversy. But just that line of about, you know, a girl calmly and simply explaining that she lost her virginity was enough to have MTV ban the song, I believe, after not long, and essentially stopped the entire album in its tracks. There was no chance of it succeeding.
Yeah, and it's very weird. It's a very weird excuse to use, I think, and or someone had a tizzy over a line when there's probably much worse that's probably played than that.
Well, yeah, I actually looked right around the same time on MTV toward the end of 2004, the beginning of 2005. You had like Grind With Me by Pretty Ricky, My Humps,
yeah.
Candy Shop, Don'tcha by the Pussycat Dolls. That's what was being fed to kids and teens and everyone happily, but...
Yeah, and here's a question for you. Billboard's Top 100 for 2004, the same year that was out, do you know what was number one at the top of that chart, at the end of the year chart?
End of the year 2004. Oh, probably like something by Nelly. I don't know.
It was Yeah by Usher.
I was close.
Yeah. Yeah by Usher, and which played on MTV loads because I remember it being on there, and pretty much is still in the public consciousness because when I was an usher at my friend's wedding, my other friends, when they're walking up when I was outside the church ready to shoo them in, was walking up playing the song on the phones. There's a bit of a double standard, I think, with that as well, because some of the lyrics in that, particularly with Ludacris's verse, contains some not that subtle lyrics, and I'm going to read out the Ludacris verse, and I just want to point out some of the lyrics on there and compare it to the short bridge from Vanessa Carlton. So I'm going to go and do a dramatic reading of Yeah by Usher, verse 3 by Ludacris, and I'm just going to get into character, and I want you to just focus on what exactly Mr. Ludacris is talking about. Watch out. My outfit's ridiculous. In the club looking so conspicuous. And roar, these women all on the prowl. If you hold the head steady, I'ma milk the cow. And forget about game. I'ma spit the truth. and I won't stop until I get them in their birthday suit. So give me the rhythm, and it'll be off with their clothes, then bend over to the front and touch your toes. I left the jag, and I took the rolls. If they ain't cutting, then I put them on foot patrol. How'd you like me now, when my pinky's valued over 300,000? Let's drink, you're the one to please. Ludicrous fill cups like double D's. Me and Ushies once more, and we leaves them dead. We want a lady in the street, but a freak in the bed.
Bravo.
And,
bravo.
I mean, like, there's like explicit reference to oral sex in that.
More than some other things.
Yeah, I mean, like, if you hold the head steady, I'm gonna milk the cow. I mean, come on.
Ludicrous, a lifelong and avid farmer, is just telling you the right way. That's all it is.
Yeah, he's about, like, safe driving and, like, yeah, and he says, like, I'm assuming if I ain't cutting, then I put him on foot patrol. I'm assuming that's just someone, no, you've had too much to drink, you're going to have to not drive. I'm sure that's what that's about.
Yes, absolutely. It's really just club safety and farmhand advice. And maybe that's really why Vanessa Carlton couldn't cut it. She just didn't have either of those.
Yeah, unless My First Time Hard to Explain is about her helping a cow give birth. That's what she should have said.
Or, like, I don't know, doing some sort of dance, like a hip-hop dance. I had one in my brain and I forgot what it was called.
Yeah.
Crumping. Was it doing crunk or crump or something back then?
Crunk. Yeah.
It's really about her first encounter doing crunk dancing.
Yeah. Well, she should have had little John going, My First Time. Yeah. Hard to Explain. Rush of Blood. Yeah. And a little bit of pain. That's what, pretty much every song in 2004 should have had a little John going, yeah, in the background.
I think they did after a certain point, but back to the point you were getting at with that beautiful rendition. There's a huge double standard there, and I mean, it still exists today to a point, but I think the Vanessa was put in box A, where you're supposed to be cute and chaste, and everyone else essentially was put into box B, where you can be raunchy as long as you don't say the word penis. And if I can't say that on your show, just bleep it out.
That's fine. I did a radio version of the thing. So it's fine. But it's if you think about, I think it was 2 years beforehand when Christina Aguilera released Dirty, which was pretty much talking about the double standards in music as well. And considering that since that song, it still kind of was played, it kind of highlights that very weird and just baffling double standard of stuff. I mean,
it's almost like you have to reach a certain point of notoriety to be allowed to be raunchy. Like,
yeah, I mean, if you look at, I mean, I think what Lil Kim. I don't think she had anything on mainstream. Lil Kim was like called porno rap at one point.
Accurately so, but
yeah, and then you've got Nicki Minaj, who has songs called Anaconda, which is pretty much a reference to penises, and even Baby Got Back in like the early 90s was saying my anaconda don't want if you haven't got buns son or something, which it's just censorship in the US kind of baffles me at times, and it's probably down to advertisers and MTV like money and stuff on MTV for basically a discussion of like losing your virginity or something, and I don't get it. I don't understand the difference.
I honestly think it came down to the fact that it wasn't sexy. That's one of my biggest takeaways, is that she spoke about sex in a common, average way instead of making it hypersexualized, which seems to be fine. So I don't understand why that's a disconnect that exists, but that seems to be a big part of why this album failed.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the commercial aspect of it is based on that small bridge. So if people are still wondering why they're still talking about that bridge, I think a lot of stuff online was actually talking about that the impact of the song White Houses is pretty much what was blamed for basically the lack of momentum that the album got.
Well, yeah, it was after this was released and not well received by networks or whatever, they essentially told her that the rest of the tracks were garbage and not fit for singles and wanted her to make new ones. So I can see the animosity there, which in hindsight makes sense. She was why she was so cranky when I saw her in concert live during this tour.
I'll ask you about that a bit later on. But actually, saying that, I was just having, again, just looking on the Wikipedia page. I think Carlton actually attributed the censoring of the song to the infamous Super Bowl halftime show with Janet Jackson, because that was that year, earlier that year, and that had a massive impact that had, or like lots of shit that was lost from people because of that.
This year's Super Bowl show was the first sexy one since Nipplegate, really. They shied away from the sex appeal on stage for fear of something else happening, because that Janet issue just, it made people really clamp, conservatives really clamp down.
Yeah, and so I think with that, particularly with that as like an impact, with the impact of that, you can perhaps see why some people jump to that, but then, I don't know, you've got like, whatever. Any other songs on the album that you perhaps want to talk about? Because you made a reference to the vampire song in a conversation between us, and I was trying to find out which song that was.
Well, it's Vampires or Werewolves, Half a Week Before the Winter.
Yes.
Vampires are growing tired, powerful, in coats of white or something ridiculous. That song haunts me to this day, because it doesn't fit the album at all.
No, so this is like one of the, I'm guessing one of the examples of it just being quite weird and all over the place, because it's like a darker pop song about, like, the vampires are growing tired, the coats of white all turn to red, my heart burns with desire, I carry on, carry on. Again, see, that sounds a lot more like, it sounds like more what they should have put on MTV, with little John going, yeah, in the background.
It seems like some sort of fever dream that she brought us into, which I don't dislike, but
I think it's like at that point where kind of like the album sort of starts just experimenting a bit further. Then you get to stuff like, I think, She Floats, which is like a very haunting, slow piano, kind of like piano ballad, which...
Yeah, it was kind of out of... It's another one where I felt a little haunted by it. Kind of the deeper you go into the album from Private Radio on, it all gets a little haunted, a little creepy. And then, of course, she hid the wreckage at the end just to make it extra creepy.
Yeah, the wreckage sounds a lot like, pretty much, I think, I don't want to say formulaic, but you've got kind of like the hidden track at the end of albums where it's kind of like the artist and a single instrument just doing the same thing, not doing the same thing, but kind of working towards like a demonument or additional like encore after you've had the finale. But as I said, I think from Private Radio, the songs kind of take a weird twist into more experimental pop. But this is the part where I was on about earlier, where she kind of wanted to be more like Regina Spektor and that ilk. Because this is a lot more experimental and a lot more like what I think they would have done. So it feels less poppy and more experimental.
Yeah, it's almost like Private Radio is kind of the gateway that lets us step into her brain. And from then on out, things get a little weird, because she gets very lyrically open. I wouldn't say honest, because I don't think she's been around too many vampires, but she really exposes a lot more of what she's thinking about.
Kind of like the wreckage, I think, has like the imagery of basically a car accident, but I quite like the lyrics of that, where it kind of, it pretty much feels like the leaving some like quite a negative part of life away. So I'm speeding to the horizon, dreaming of the sirens, wishing for the broken glass on the highway. It could be so easy. Whereas it's either like talking about leaving or wishing to leave.
Yeah, it's definitely wishing for some kind of really aggressive evolution.
Okay, so but do you prefer the first half or the second half?
I'm sorry, the second half of the album, yeah.
Okay, and why is that?
I think really the second half, I feel like she really kicks it up a notch in terms of her piano skills and really showing those off. And I love the way with Papa, it almost feels like the lyrics follow the melody and not the other way around. It's a very just winding up and down. I don't know any of the fancy piano terms, but it's a really captivating sound. And then if you listen to the actual words, I wonder now how much of that those lyrics were talking more about the industry, the people she was around, you know, love, plastic love, you're a genuine wannabe, especially when we're talking about the boxes that A&R maybe tried to put her in or people get put in general. I think there's a lot of insight in some of those songs.
I think as the album goes, like, sequentially as well, I think you can kind of see her get kind of braver with what she's talking about. As you said, I think she gets more critical with what, and so I think particularly with Papa, as you just said, she gets more critical of what she was involved in, and and particularly I think where she ends up as well, but we'll get to that a bit later. So that was like the album itself. Before we move on, briefly about the reception of the album and its performance, so to speak. In terms of charts, it didn't, say, I think because of the whole thing about White Houses, it didn't do that well in comparison to perhaps other albums that have been talked about on the podcast. Wikipedia's chart section only says it got onto three charts. It got to the US Billboard 200 at number 33. It got to 10 on the Taiwanese albums chart. And I think the Oricon albums chart from Japan, he got to 52, and that's all the information that was there.
Yeah, it definitely seems like, again, there was really no publicity train behind the album, and no one other than Carlton really seemed to try to get it anywhere, so it didn't go anywhere.
Yeah, if we briefly look on Metacritic, it's got 54 out of 100 for Metacritic, because the highest one it's got was from E Online with 75, and he goes that the lyrics sound like teen soap opera scripts and music so mellow it makes Dido sound like an espresso junkie. Songs like White Houses and She Floats are tailor-made to soothe the soul.
See, that really sounds like a review from someone who didn't really listen to the album. it's a very surface level review, but I guess that was kind of the problem, was everyone took the album at surface level and didn't delve into it. And I think that's a good example of that. I read a quote from her where she wanted it to really be her Sergeant Peppers. She wanted it to be a single woman Sergeant Peppers. And I think that quote, honestly, a lot of the weirdness resolves itself just by knowing that. Because the big orchestra pieces and then the lighter, more twinkly sounds, I can see what she was going for. And it kind of makes me mad that we didn't get that album, because I don't think we ever got the album she wanted out of Harmonium because of all the stuff going on behind the scenes.
I know you've probably just referenced the answer to this, but I know the answer. So, have you ever seen her live?
Yes, I have. I saw her. I would say it was probably the end of 2004 or the beginning of 2005. So, a while ago, as we talked about, the last season of Angel was on TV. But I saw her live. She came to my university, and she was amazing. She was captivating. But now that I think about it, because I've been kind of trying to ruminate on that experience, I don't even think she had a piano. I think she just had a keyboard. It was really, in hindsight, it was actually a really lackluster display that kind of showed how little they cared about the tour, because it was just her on a stage with a keyboard and no backing, no strings. Like, there are those big instrumental pieces and there was nothing. So I loved it. I remember feeling some of the later songs like in my bones, like The Wreckage. And I remember her seeming kind of like she didn't want to be there, but not, I don't know. It's hard to, like, she was very, like, she messed up the words to Thousand Miles, and she's, like, totally biffed them, which was weird to me at the time, like, her most famous song, and she messed up. But in hindsight, I'm actually wondering if she didn't want to be playing that song, or, so knowing what I do know about her today really makes me see that whole concert in a different light.
And what kind of stuff do you mean, in terms of, like, what do you know about today?
Well, like, what happened behind the scenes with the album, like, knowing how little faith the executives had in it, and the fact that, you know, they didn't want to support it, that really explains why it was such a bare bones concert. Like, it's a headlining tour for your new album, and it's literally just you on a stage. I always thought the sparseness was, I don't know, intentional, but now thinking about it, I feel like it just shows really the lack of support and faith to the people who were working on it with her really had in the album.
It might have been a case that she couldn't carry a massive grand piano around with her, so it was just down to a keyboard. I mean, she probably wasn't.
Maybe, but it was actually in an art center that I know for a fact has like pianos and stuff, so I'm not sure. But it really seemed like she wasn't able to give the shows the album deserved. I think that was my biggest takeaway. But I got to have a picture with her after, and she was very sweet. And I messaged some of my college friends, seeing if any of them could dredge up a copy of the photo, but no luck. I believe it's on MySpace somewhere.
Okay. So I know I can't actually get into my MySpace account anymore, mainly because the email that I use doesn't exist.
Same here, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So, and you've not seen her again since, it's the only time you've seen her.
I haven't seen her again. I have purchased albums since, but I don't think she's come anywhere near me. And I'm sure she's coming to Boston. But I do think it's funny. We talked a second ago about how Lindsay Buckingham did guitar for this album.
Yeah.
The next album, I think it's Heroes and Thieves. She actually does. She does a duet with Stevie Nicks.
Talking about the next album, from other albums, which other albums would you recommend if people are listening to Vanessa Carlton for the first time with this album?
I think Heroes and Thieves. I would definitely listen to that rather than go back to Be Not Nobody, because I really think Heroes and Thieves continues the evolution of Carlton as an artist and not Carlton as the artist people tried to make her.
Okay.
Plus, yeah, I'll listen to anything that's got Stevie Nicks on it, but I don't think it's not a better album than this one, but it's not a worse album. It's different again. It seems like every album she kind of reinvents or tries to tweak how she's expressing stuff.
Reading about Heroes and Thieves, I think it was apparently it's her most highest rated album on Metacritic. And the very interesting thing about it, which my head still can't click with, that I messaged you about, was that one of the producers of the album was Irv Gotti, and the album was released on Murder. Well, it was known as Murder Inc. back then. So basically, she was on the same label as Ja Rule.
Yeah, I was waiting for the Vanessa Carlton, Ja Rule, Ashanti, but it never happened, sadly. But I think she was actually there. I think she was actually his first sign after they dropped The Murder and went to The Ink.
Yeah.
So I have a feeling that it was a publicity stunt, but it's definitely a mind bender.
I mean, like, for example, if you look at the former artist section of The Ink Rule, it's not that big unless it's not the full version, but you got Ja Rule, Ashanti, someone called Lloyd, who's a singer, R&B singer, someone called Vita, Charlie Baltimore, who I'm aware of, who Vanessa Carlton, an artist called Black Child.
So essentially it's her and Ja Rule, really.
Yeah. The other two, Cadillac Tar and Murder Inc., which is the name of the artist, are actually just revert back to the Wikipedia article. And the last name on there is Christina Milian, who was only there for about 2 years anyway. So it's a very weird. So I wonder if it's just like an experiment that didn't go, that went wrong, because I think she left. I think she left the Ink right very soon after the album cycle was finished. And one of the producers actually as well was Linda Perry from Four Non Blondes on the album. So it's alongside, I think, Stephen Jenkins, it's a very strange mix of producers on that album, actually.
Yeah, she seems to just make these weird music microcosms happen when she's creating an album.
I think she came out with another one in 2011, Rabbits on the Run, and there's one called Liberman in 2015, and I think she's actually starting to moving towards releasing something else as well, because I think she did like a Tiny Desk or an NPR concert about a couple of weeks ago that came out, so I think she's still touring regularly, and I think she has got something new coming out.
I honestly didn't realize she put out that many albums since this one, so you've given me a couple new things to listen to.
Okay, yeah, so I think she's got two. I think she's got, well, after the third one, I think, yeah, she's got one from, two more. So, yeah, so that's Vanessa Carlton's rest of discography. So, definitely want to check out if you want to listen to any more by her. So, as we're gearing up to the end, we're getting up to the key question, Kylie, the important part, which is the song for the playlist. So this, for anyone not listen, who's listening to this for the first time, what this is I speak to the guest and they nominate one song from the album to be immortalised forever in a Spotify playlist or for however long Spotify lasts. And I have no input into it. So whatever you say, go. So Kylie, which song are you going to pick for the playlist?
That's a great question. I know we didn't talk about it a lot, but I actually think that I would have to go with Afterglow, because I think it's closer to Thousand Miles in Tone than some of the other ones, but I think she's sprinkles in more of the depth and the authenticity from this album, and I think it'd be a great jumping off point for people who might have heard her old stuff but haven't heard this.
Okay.
But yeah, definitely Afterglow.
So Afterglow joins the pantheon of other songs from previous artists, which and probably segues quite nicely from the song that goes before it, which is from Caroline Polachek. So Hit Me Where It Hurts by Caroline Polachek. On to Afterglow. Yeah. And which will then be followed by the 30th episode next fortnight. So that's it. That's the end of your second go at picking a disc, Kaylee. So have you enjoyed it?
I have. I have to say I'm really glad that I'm the one before the 30th, because I don't want to be responsible for any mishaps on such a momentous occasion.
Peek behind the Iron Curtain, the 30th's already been recorded at ahead of time.
Oh, yeah. I'm not surprised. You're on the ball with that, so...
he says recording this like a week before it's due to come out, but Kylie, thank you ever so much for joining me again, and
thank you for indulging my weird fascination on a 15-year-old album.
Yeah. But yeah, so if people want to follow you or your endeavors, where can they find you online?
I'm not doing much of anything right now, folks, but I am, I shall grow on Instagram if you want to, read my writing or see me occasionally poke fun at Matt on his various social medias.
Yes, you can do, yes. But so if you want to, if you want to follow Pick a Disc, and then just see Kaylee kind of like randomly comment on them, then feel free to. In fact, I encourage you to follow Pick a Disc, like I said at the start. But
follow, the weirder I will get. How about that? No, don't do that, guys.
you heard it here first, folks. And with that, it's time for us to say goodbye. It's been great to have you on here again, and thank you ever so much.
Yeah, you have a good one.
You've been listening to Pick a Disc, and I've been your host, Matthew Layla. Our theme music is Pump by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com. Pick a Disc is hosted by the We Made This Podcast Network, and you can find them on www.spreaker.com/user/WeMadeThis. You can find the Pick a Disc show site on www.spreaker.com/show/pickadisc. You can find us on all the usual social media type places like Facebook, Instagram, Twitter under Pick a Disc. You can also email us on pickadisc@gmail.com. Until next time, happy listening to all those discs that you are picking.
It is such an exquisite body of work. Just like start to finish, it's 14 tracks and they're all just majestic. I don't know how else to... How else would you explain it, really? In my life, I feel like I'm currently having some sort of pop quarter-life crisis. I have just, for as long as I can remember, I've listened to like sad indie songs and like indie folk and straight for, you know, a lot of country, that kind of stuff, just sad stuff. And I'm turning 25 on Sunday, and something in me has switched, and I'm like, I need to listen to pop, like loads of it. I need to blast pop in my ears until I'm completely sick of it.
Won't forget me.
And I guess this is the whole thing about her appeal, and you know that I say in the book quite a lot. I talk a little bit about, you know, the fact that these are the two actors that Brown is most associated with, between Crawford and Garbo, but you know, Garbo was kind of the thoroughbred, as it were, mm-hmm. and Crawford was the, you know, with not being pejorative, but the kind of cash cow. She's the one that actually was bringing in the box office for MGM, for the American box office, you know. And that's what I think is interesting, that she can appeal, especially in a film like Possessed. She can have the very glamorous, sleek look, but she can also appeal to the ordinary people going in the Depression era to the movies and identifying with her. So she has that kind of appeal that is expressed through her acting and through the characters, but also through her looks.
The Giddy Carousel of Pop.
Yeah, I mean, it's not what you would expect from a band that would be considered a punk band. They're not giving it all that, are they?
No, I mean, see that performance again. It's just the kind of cartoon sort of punk that was made for smash hits in some ways.
Yeah.
And smash hits readers. But yeah. I think, you know, Top of the Pops, talking about Top of the Pops, I mean, their favourites seem to be Sham 69, so they were always on. So a particular kind of punk was obviously acceptable at the BBC.
When I looked at the lyrics, I'd not realised before, it's a song about Elvis having a fight with John Lennon, isn't it? To see who's the best, who's the king rocker.
Yeah.
And that passed me by. So, like you say, not a very punk thing maybe to sing about, really.
No, it's not singing about anarchy.
Check out all of these shows on the We Made This podcast network.